But first, I have a very special guest today, Deepa Iyer, author of We Too Sing America. Deepa Iyer is a national figure in movements for racial and immigrant justice in America. She served as executive director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, or SALT, for a decade. And SALT is the only national progressive South Asian organization in the U.S. Currently, Deepa Iyer serves as a senior fellow at the Center for Social Inclusion, where she addresses issues of structural racism and multiracial solidarity. You may be familiar with her work from sharply written op-eds in The New York Times, The Nation, and The Huffington Post. Deepa is also a friend to KBOO. She joined us on APA Compass to talk about the impact of September 11th on South Asian American community 10 years later. And she joined us again last year on APA Compass with a powerful Angry APA Minute as a call to action for APA communities to join the Black Lives Matter movement. Again, her book is called We Too Sing America. And Deepa joins me by phone. Deepa, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Thanks for having me, Zarika.
Congratulations on the success of your first book, We Too Sing America.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It seems rather timely right now in an unfortunate way.
Exactly. And we are going to get to that just in a moment. I want to begin with a little bit of history. I think most people are aware that Muslim Americans, Arabs, Sikh Americans, and South Asian Americans have faced particular hate crimes and scrutiny and racial profiling post-September 11th. The federal government took on several new functions after September 11th, many of which operated in direct contradiction with each other. Tell us about this schism.
Sure. So right after 9/11, in the weeks after 9/11, we noticed that the federal government was implementing a range of what they called national security policies. Many of these also included using immigration laws. They detained, deported, surveilled, profiled a number of people who were Arab, South Asian, and Muslim. At the same time, the government was also trying to reach out to communities that were affected by the backlash that we saw right after 9/11. These would be incidents of hate violence or employment discrimination or any sort of bullying at schools. And at the time, I was actually working at the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice and worked with several lawyers to really get information out to our communities about their rights and how they could enforce their rights if they were violated. But what has happened over the years is the schism that you mentioned, which is that the government at times is trying to act as a champion and enforcer of civil rights, of justice, but at the same time, other arms of the government are engaging in profiling or surveillance or ethnic or religious mapping of our communities as well. And so that conundrum, that conflict, is something that our communities have really seen the impact of in terms of distrust of government, in terms of not knowing if they can turn to the government and the like.
Exactly. And perhaps the most harmful state policy implemented in the wake of September 11th is the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, or NSEERS, NSEERS. What does this reveal about official assumptions about international visitors, temporary workers, and students from very specific nations?
NSEERS is one of those policies that I had mentioned just a bit ago, one of those policies that were implemented in the wake of 9/11, again, ostensibly to secure our borders, to get a better understanding of nationals of other countries here in the U.S., when they entered, where they lived, what their immigration history was, and the like. But unfortunately, NSEERS only applied to people from 28 countries in the Southeast and in South Asia and the Middle East, what we would call majority Muslim countries. And it applied to men who were 16 years and older who were asked to report to their local immigration agencies. So this was happening in 2003, and it largely really escaped the attention of mainstream media and the public. What advocates have talked about with this particular program is that it was a form of blatant profiling. It focused on people from particular countries around the world, and it focused on people who practiced a particular faith. When these men actually went to their immigration offices to, quote, register, they were asked a range of questions that seemed quite irrelevant to their immigration history, such as where they prayed, for example, what mosques they attended, and the like. And at the end of the day, thousands of men were actually deported from our country back to their home countries, and it really altered the living situations of many families here. It changed the way that small businesses operated, that had to shut down. It changed the landscape of immigrant neighborhoods from New York to Los Angeles. So it's one of those policies that it's not in place in the same way right now. Advocacy work has listed this policy under the Obama administration. It's not in place. However, we hear echoes of it still, even with Donald Trump, for example, recently talking about issuing special identification cards to Muslims. It's all part and parcel of this feeling that certain communities are othered and are seen as suspicious in our country.
Right. This is a history that seems to repeat itself. And one of the stories you gave as an example of how this impacted families was the story of Yves Gomez and her family. Talk about this family, because this was maybe it was not such a unique situation, but it was certainly a telling story.
Yes. So the situation of Yves Gomez is actually in the book as an example of a family that endured criminalization through the immigration detention and deportation system. And so it traces how Yves and his brother were brought to the United States when they were quite young. Yves actually was quite young when he was brought here, and his brother was born here. They lived in Silver Spring, Maryland. His parents had applied for asylum in the United States, but they had fallen out of status because the application had been denied. They did not know about this. There's a lot of bureaucracy in the immigration system that occurs, as you likely know. And so one day, Yves and his family woke up to the sounds of immigration agents knocking on their front door, and Yves' father was taken away. And shortly thereafter, he was deported, and Yves' mother was deported as well. And then it came down to Yves and the deportation system looking at him as the next person to remove, because he had been undocumented and out of status as well. So the story of Yves really traces how Yves and others got engaged in the movement on immigrant rights. And Yves took a lot of risks, as other dreamers do, young people who brought into this country early in their lives, have lived here their whole lives, but are out of status. But it looks at how they really risk their bodies, their lives, their security by talking about their stories. Thankfully, Yves was able to get relief from deportation and is still in the country and is still advocating on immigrant rights issues and other justice issues. But I looked at that particular story for two reasons. One, to show the impact and scope of the deportation system in this country and how it arbitrarily separates families. And secondly, to show that South Asians, too, are undocumented in this country. A lot of people feel that undocumented immigration is only affecting Latino communities, but that's clearly not true. So I wanted to lift up some of the stories of undocumented youth in the South Asian community, both to show that they are a part of this movement, but that they are also expanding how we think about and what we think about undocumented immigrants.
I'm glad you brought up that this rhetoric about undocumented youth being looked at as only Latinos. You talk about that in your book. In fact, there's a whole chapter on the power of undocumented youth, undocumented queer youth, creating coalitions and rising together. Yves is one example, but there were also examples of Prerna Lal and Bhupen Ram. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Sure. So Prerna Lal and Bhupen Ram are also undocumented youth and young people who have been active in the immigrant rights movement. And I think one way in which I wrote about their stories in particular is that both Bhupen as well as Prerna are queer. And so they have been able to really talk about intersections, right? They've been able to show how being queer and undocumented and South Asian in this country has unique challenges and unique impacts and effects. And so they've been able to lift that up, I think, for people to show how these different forms of identity that we all carry, these multiple forms of identity, can really lead to unique challenges for our community members.
Back to what you were talking about before, about othering our communities either overtly or covertly, or feeling the impact from previous policies. You begin the book at the 2012 Oak Creek Sikh Temple massacre in Wisconsin. And this is just one example of violence targeted at South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh communities in the U.S. after September 11th. And this violence actually has a longer history. So briefly tell us about this longer history.
Sure. So the book is focused on post-9/11 America, the 14 years after 9/11. But I wanted to make the point, I think it's important to note that while there was unprecedented backlash against South Asian Muslim, Arab, and Sikh immigrant communities after 9/11, that the history of violence against these communities extends much further. And so I talk a little bit about, I trace, particularly for the South Asian community, how anti-Asian exclusion laws as well as riots occurred at the turn of the 20th century to target South Asian. At the time, they were mainly Hindu and Sikh migrant laborers all up and down the West Coast in particular. I also talk about how in the 80s, South Asians in New Jersey were subjected to the hate violence and hate rhetoric of a group of people in those neighborhoods who did not want these new immigrants settling in. They were called the Dot Busters, the particular group of people that targeted South Asian residents, business owners who had moved into neighborhoods in Jersey. I also talk about other types of hate sprees that occurred that targeted South Asian communities in particular. So the lead up to 9/11, you know, I think it's important to remember that South Asians were reporting the highest numbers of hate incidents in the late 90s. And so when you got to 2001, obviously after 9/11, those numbers just really went through the roof. And unfortunately, after 14 years, we continue to see discriminatory acts, hate violence, continue against these communities. And as you mentioned, one of those examples is, of course, the massacre that occurred at the Sikh Gurdwara in 2012.
And what exactly does hate crime laws do for victims, and what are their limitations?
Well, we have hate crimes laws at the federal level as well as in many states around the country, and what they do is they basically send a message that we will not tolerate violence against people based on immutable circumstances, whether that's race and color or faith, or whether it's sexual orientation or gender identity. And so the federal hate crimes law that's in place right now allows local and federal law enforcement to investigate crimes of hate and to bring charges against perpetrators. But as with many laws in the justice system, there are limits, and oftentimes the ways that community members are affected and impacted go well beyond the legal system. So in terms of the Oak Creek massacre, I talk about how there were immigration implications, mental health implications, safety implications that affected the Oak Creek Sikh community as well as other community members living in the area. And so what I really argue in the book is that we need a multi-pronged approach to addressing and eliminating hate violence. Law and policy alone cannot be enough. We need cultural narrative changes that make sure that these communities are not seen as potential suspects or people to fear. We need policy initiatives at the state and federal level in the form of task forces that address hate violence against these communities and try to address them at their core and their roots. And we need to look at how there are organized hate groups that have been forming in this country that do target these communities and others in particular, and how can those be monitored, and how do we deal with those all around the country?
This is a good segue to my next set of questions. You know, we were talking about in recent news and politics, we brought up Donald Trump, but we also have, just the past 2 weeks alone, we've had a number of acts of violence at the massive level. And I wanted to look at the recent mass shootings, both domestically and internationally. In the wake of the massacre in Paris, our country's state governors have responded with declining Syrian refugee entry to their states. Not that they have the power to do that. But this is history repeating itself and speaks to a convoluted understanding of the plight of refugees. But again, this othering of specific communities. And talk a little bit about that.
That's right. You know, unfortunately, we are seeing sort of a similar cycle that has developed in the wake of the horrific attacks in Paris. And what that has meant in the United States is this sort of let's close our borders response, a xenophobic response to refugees in particular, as you noted, Syrian refugees. We have also seen another wave of backlash targeting Muslim, Arab, South Asian immigrant communities in this country as well. And that has included, for example, vandalism to mosques around the country, to Muslim women who have reported that they have been choked by their headscarves by perpetrators, students who have been called terrorists, and "This is for Paris" yelled at them. So a range of different forms of backlash that, again, really put on a collective guilt, the sense of collective guilt and responsibility that Muslim communities seem to have to shoulder, that no one else needs to in the wake of attacks like this, right? And so we are seeing that develop again. So it's this confluence of policy, calls for restricting immigration policy, greater surveillance. We are also seeing really kind of divisive and harmful rhetoric, political rhetoric, media rhetoric about these communities. And then thirdly, these individual acts of discrimination or violence. And so all three really reinforce each other to create a climate of fear, a heightened climate of suspicion that affects our community members.
And yet, on the other hand, there is a reality to the gunmen behind certain massacres that they're confirmed, for example, in Charleston and in Colorado recently, for example, these are white men. Whereas in California, you know, the latest news I've heard is that this was somebody who was connected to ISIS. And the way the political rhetoric responds to this is, for me personally, it's kind of a tightening in my chest. You know, can you comment a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, certainly, I think the first thing important to say is that the attacks that occurred in California a few days ago were horrific. You know, the lives that were taken by these shooters and the chaos that they ended up creating in that developmental center. I mean, I can't even imagine how people in that community are dealing with the aftermath of it.
Absolutely.
And it's also important to remember that this is the 355th, I believe, mass shooting that has happened in our country, and gun violence has really become ubiquitous.
In this year alone, in 2015.
In this year alone,
right.
Exactly. Thank you. And simultaneously, I think that it's also important that we don't ignore how this particular shooting has been characterized, you know, kind of getting to what you were talking about earlier, both in the media and in terms of political rhetoric. You know, there are, again, these assumptions of collective guilt and responsibility that are foisted upon Muslim communities, South Asian Arab communities, when the perpetrators turn out to be from those communities. But there's a double standard, right, that many have pointed out, that those sorts of responses are not ones that we make when the perpetrator turns out to be white. So just four days, I believe, before the attacks in California, we had another attack by a white man outside a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. And the responses, if you compare the responses from in the media as well as from political leaders, are quite different. We don't necessarily call attacks by Robert Deere or Dylann Roof acts of domestic terrorism. We don't ask for apologies or condemnations, or, you know, we don't assume the guilt of all people who belong to the communities that Deere and Roof belong to. And so there is a double standard. There's racial coding in the language that we use. And I think it's important to say this not only because it's a semantic issue, it goes well beyond that, because what happens with Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities is that there is also this the result of this, and sometimes the result of being irresponsible in how we are characterizing these incidents, is that people are subjected to backlash again. Because folks see all people from these communities as being suspicious, and that they should be scapegoated for the vile acts of a few people. And unfortunately, we are looking at incidents again in the last couple of days. I mean, just earlier today, a mosque in Manassas, Virginia, reported receiving a threatening voicemail where someone was saying that they were retaliating for what had happened in California. So that's the climate that we're in, and because, as we were just talking about, the climate is already heightened with what, in light of the attacks in Paris, this is kind of a double tightening that people are feeling right now.
Absolutely.
I think that anxious
Absolutely.
Tightening of the chest, as you mentioned, is something that many members of our communities are feeling.
Right. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. Deepa Iyer is a racial justice activist and the author of the powerful and informative We Too Sing America. Everyone should get a copy and read this. Deepa Iyer, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me on these very difficult topics on Intersections Radio.
Thank you, Sarika. My pleasure.